The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panellists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Today we sit down with a London-based designer, Michael Anastasiades, as the luminary sheds a little light on his creative practices and a turn back to furniture.
In one case, you need to challenge yourself. In another way, it's nice also to be able to have conversations and to be able to be challenged by other people rather than being the one behind your own challenges.
Plus, we take time with a Saudi princess who organized the nation's inaugural Fashion Week.
I want Saudi designers to grow and to feel like they can do it. They can be part of history, they can participate, they can show their work to the world.
Also, we learn our arsenale from our elbow in a look ahead to the Venice Architecture Biennale later this month. All that coming up right here in the next half hour on Monocle on Design. Do get comfortable. The name Michael Anastasiades might be a long one, but it's one that trips off the tongues of many on the industrial design circuit. The Cyprus-born product designer set up his eponymous design studio here in London back in 1994. This year also marks a decade since he set up his lighting brand, a celebrated line that's known for its minimal geometric creations and collaborations with the likes of Italian firm Floss. Now, a few weeks ago at this year's Milan Design Week, Anastasiades turned his talented hand back to furniture in an inaugural partnership with Italian firm Cassina. Monocle's Daphne Carnesis took a seat on a doubtlessly sumptuous sofa at Cassina's showroom on Via Durini in the Lombard capital to find out just a little more.
I've had my studio since 1994, and in 2007 decided to set up my own brand in order to produce a collection of lighting pieces. This year it's 10 years old, and it was an idea for me to be able to launch my ideas without compromise. Later on, I got an invitation by different companies to design for them. My first big partnership was Floss. That was in 2011, with the first product in 2013, and this year is the first collaboration with Italian brands on furniture. So it's a very exciting time for me.
And have you been coming to Milan to Design Week for some years now? And what do you think about this year and how Milan has sort of progressed?
I started coming to Milan in 1993, as soon as I graduated from the Royal College of Art. Of course, back then, it was different times. I was a student, dreaming one day that perhaps I could design for these big companies. But the reality is, as a young designer at the time, you're never invited to the party. So, you know, big brands want to work with already established names. At the same time, if you're not given the opportunity to show what you can do, it's a very, almost like a vicious circle. So that was another reason why I set up my own brand, was to release my ideas and show what I could do with it. And then eventually here I am. Many years later, it's a very different story. I am invited to the parties, but at the same time, I don't see myself being in a better place. I mean, I still think that those years were very important, and you need to be tested to get where you are.
And so you think there are both positives and negatives when it comes to working, you know, alone in with your own studio versus, you know, being hired by another brand with a perhaps more specific brief?
Absolutely, because in both cases, there's challenges. In one case, you need to challenge yourself. It requires an enormous amount of discipline. In another way, it's nice also to be able to have conversations and to be able to be challenged by other people rather than being the one behind your own challenges. I think the perfect scenario would be to be able to strike a balance. At this very moment, I continue with my brand. I also have collaborations with other brands. So I feel lucky that I'm given both these opportunities.
Where exactly in London is your studio based? How many people are you? How big is your team? Tell me a bit about your working methods with the team. Do you work on prototypes before you, you know, submit something to the client?
We recently moved studio to Camden. I used to host my studio in my own home for about 10 years. Ever since I started my brand in 2007, it was a time that I needed to move because the studio grew. There were many people coming through my door every day. I now employ 8 people. I have 3 designers that work with me, designing for my own brand, as well as designing for other brands. So we work incredibly closely on those ideas. The rest of the team runs the brand because we manufacture and we sell. What you can see here is a very simple design. It's called Ordinal. The name is also interesting because I think it reflects very much the principle behind the design. Just for those of you that don't know what Ordinal is, it's basically the 45 degrees in the compass. So it's southeast, southwest, northeast, and northwest. So, you know, that direction is intentional just because it gives structure to the table. So by positioning the legs on the corners of the table, you provide automatically structure. And then from then on, what I try to do is to reflect the geometry of the tabletop along the leg. So it's actually pointing to the direction of the corner and it runs all the way down to the leg. I wanted to differentiate the top with the legs. What you see here is an oak tabletop together with the anodized aluminium leg. And this differentiation of material with the anodized aluminium being something a little bit more precious. You know, in this case, you see it here in the gold finish. But it's a versatile collection and it lends itself easily to other shapes, different sizes. We have the oval one that you see there in the lacquer top and matching color, but still anodized aluminium legs. And of course, the other ones on the other side with the walnut finish.
So you're from Cyprus. How has that informed either your designs or your way of working, if it has?
You can never define how your background affects your work, but I certainly think it has done in my case. You know, everything you do in life, every experience you have, somehow subconsciously comes out in your work. I would say that the humor is an interesting thing that is quite Greek. It's from where I come from, and I think that subtlety is there and quite pronounced in the work that I produce.
Talking about lighting again, it's a sector that's become, I feel, quite crowded. There are many, many, many designers, perhaps more so than other product categories. What do you think about the lighting sector at the moment and how it's evolved since you started out?
When I started my brand in 2007, it was a different scenario. Back then, there were not that many brands, of course. I decided to focus on lighting and not produce other pieces like furniture pieces, or we produced very little tabletop pieces, but it was more to complete the story and accessorize that collection. Ever since, there's so many brands that have appeared. There is room for everyone. I mean, that's what's interesting about it. I think the most important thing is that everybody should focus in what they're good at and what they can actually say in a different way. The worrying bit is when people start copying each other, is when you realize that actually it has become a very saturated environment and is almost too many of us around.
Yeah, we're seeing a bit of that, of people copying and imitating.
I'm never offended by this. I think the only thing that sometimes disturbs me with copies is they always change something and suddenly the product loses completely its credibility. If they were to copy it in exactly the same way, I wouldn't have such a big problem. I'm not fussed by the idea that somebody can make money out of my own designs. What I'm disturbed by highly is when they change things in an ugly way that it becomes something you would never have done, but it still reminds you of your product. And it's almost like seeing the ugly side of yourself in the mirror.
Designer Michael Anastasiades there, speaking to Monocle's very own Daphne Karnizis. Now, last month, Saudi Arabia hosted its first ever Fashion Week, a four-day gala held in a gilded tent in Riyadh. The driving force behind the event was Princess Noura bint Faisal Al Saudi, who is president of the Arab Fashion Council. Monocle's Jamie Waters spoke to the princess from Riyadh to hear about how this historic event came about, to discuss broader developments in the Arabic fashion industry, and ask if Riyadh might one day sit alongside cities such as London, Paris, and New York on the fashion calendar.
It was short, but we managed to make history, so I'm very, very happy. It was very positive also in regards to people that attended. They were so happy. They didn't expect this to happen, but when they came to the event and saw it, they were so impressed, and I'm so happy that all the feedback was all positive. For me, to have this all positive feedback from people, women in Saudi, was such an honor for me, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm doing this for them. I want them to feel part of this, and I want Saudi designers also to grow and to feel like they can do it. They can be part of history, they can participate, they can show their work to the world. Yeah. So for me, all this positive feedback was so touching and moving because I felt that I did something for my country.
Tell me about some of the particular hurdles that you come across when you're staging a Fashion Week event in Saudi Arabia, because it was widely reported that things like the shows were women only, quite tight restrictions on cameras. Tell us about some of these particular hurdles that you have to deal with.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Saudi Arabia is known, everyone knows the culture here and the religion and everything. So this is the first time that this event ever happened in Saudi. So in order for us to do it well, and to have everyone's support, and for people to feel welcome to come, we have to respect the culture and religion of the country. So we took that into consideration when doing this event, and that's why it was a women-only event. And because it's the first time that this is happening, it was very important to monitor the footage and the pictures so that everyone can feel safe, because a lot of women are coming here to really see the clothes, the fashion, and a lot of them want to feel comfortable. You know, they want to take off maybe their abaya, they want to sit, they want to have a cup of coffee. They don't want to feel like someone is taking pictures of them, and especially that this is the first time that it's happening. It's basically welcoming everyone. I don't want anyone to come feeling uncomfortable. And also, there's a lot of footage that came out after the event. Of course, we had to take the approval of the entertainment authority. And then if you look at the website and the Instagram and social media, you'll find a lot of pictures from Saudi Arabia for the dresses that were showcased, the models wearing them, the runway. This event was really for everyone to come, the women to come and to feel safe. And because it's the first time, we wanted to make sure that everyone felt comfortable respecting the culture, respecting the religion.
Crown Prince said recently that Saudi women can wear whatever they like in public, providing it's respectful. How much will this change Saudi fashion? How much of an impact will it have? There's been reports that modest fashion will become a much bigger industry there. What are your thoughts on the impact of it?
Women are being more fashionable in their dresses, in their abayas. So take the abaya as a traditional thing that we wear here in Saudi that we can be fashionable about. It's respectable, it's matching our culture, but at the same time, we can be fashionable in it with the colors, with the designs on it. So if you walk around Riyadh streets, you will see every woman wearing abaya looks different than the other. And that's how that impacts the fashion here.
Do you think we'll start to see women not wearing abayas in public?
In my opinion, abaya is not something restricting. I love wearing abaya. I feel it's part of my culture. Maybe other people don't see it the way I do. But for me, wearing abaya, it reminds me of my culture. And I respect it and I love it. I think everyone has their own observation on it and their own opinion towards it. But for me, abaya is not a restriction. It's just something beautiful that makes me feel close to home, to my culture. And every sector of the Middle East, every part of the Arab country has their own, I would say, taste and their own way of fashion. Like, for example, if you take Lebanon, has been known to have the fashion houses for years and years and years. Yeah. And a lot of Saudis learned from Lebanese fashion houses because they have all the textiles, the materials. They've been educated in Europe and they've been traveling to the States to also to get the more knowledge about fashion. Lebanon is a lot of Saudis learned. And like I give an example of Saudi designer Mohammed Ashi, Ashi Studio. He's couture and he's the one of the best Saudi designers. And he got his knowledge from his studios in Lebanon, actually. So the accessibility, I would say, to textiles and to fabric is maybe much easier in Lebanon. But I also feel like Saudi is the next place to have those things. And that is something that I want to work on.
How would you compare the sort of state of the retail scenes in some of these different cities? Is one much more developed? Do people shop in a different way in Dubai versus Riyadh versus Jeddah?
When you visit Dubai, yes, there are a lot of more stores than Saudi. There are a lot of more malls than Saudi. And people, a lot of people from Saudi travel to Dubai, you know, because it's close to shop. But I feel like the past year, more stores have been trying to, you know, open in Saudi, more brands are coming into Saudi, and I'm looking forward to more and more in the future. So I feel like in the future, within, I would say, the next 5 to 10 years, more brands would be established here in Saudi for people, because a lot of people that buy in Dubai are from Saudi. So the market in Dubai, a lot of stores depend on Saudi customers.
Is there a particular region or a particular country that in terms of fashion is really ready to be tapped into? So whether that's international brands coming to that place or those local designers as well, are there any particular countries that you'd single out?
I would say because most of the consumers that are purchasing from these international brands, the majority of the consumers are Saudis. So I would say that Saudi would be the next place to have all the fashion brands. And again, like I said, the future plans of manufacturing and stuff like that. So in my opinion, a lot of stores base their sales on Saudi clients. So the purchasing power is definitely in Saudi. So when you have these international brands come into Saudi and have their stores here in Saudi, it's a win-win for both parties, I would say.
Who are some of the most exciting Saudi designers?
Actually, there are a lot of Saudi brands that are doing a lot of exciting things. But the show that happened, I was very, very happy with the designers that participated and showcased their work because they did an amazing job. I mean, everyone was impressed with their designs. And these designers that participated with us have been in the industry for a very long time. So for them to be part of the first event and part of history, I think, showed the world and showed a lot of people what they're capable of. So I'm not biased to any specific designer or brand. I love them all and I purchase from all of them. So I'm very, very happy because there's so much talent and I want to do everything I can to support these Saudi designers. My door is always open for them because I want them to show the world what they're capable of. And I want to be able to help them. I think with our plans and our future goals that we would be able to do that for our Saudi designers for sure.
Princess Noura bint Faisal Al Saudi, president of the Arab Fashion Council and a driving force behind Saudi Arabia's inaugural Fashion Week there, speaking to Monocle's Jamie Waters. What's 6 months long and only visible every 2 years? Well, it's the Venice Architecture Biennale, of course. The biannual bash hosts a series of pavilions and installations, some beautiful, some thought-provoking and profound, and is set to open to the public in the Veneto capital in late May. This year's hotly anticipated instalment is curated by Yvonne Farrell and Shelley McNamara of Dublin-based Grafton Architects under the somewhat mysterious theme of free space. And we'll see the debut exhibitions from six nations, including, perhaps unexpectedly, the Vatican. For a sneak peek of what's ahead, I turn to design journalist and the curator of modern architecture at Stockholm's ArcDes, and of course, friend of the show, James Taylor Foster, to find out.
I think anything at Venice is important when it comes to the fields of architecture, art, design. The Venice Biennale is the most important event about architecture in the world. I mean, I'm saying this against the backdrop of a whole proliferation of biennales and triennales and events of its kind around the world, but nothing beats Venice. It's this sort of ancient meeting place in Europe, a crossroads for people, and for 1 week especially, and then 6 months every 2 years, it becomes this massive meeting place for architects, designers, and anyone interested in architecture and design.
And it's got a somewhat peculiar model in the sense that rather than being different studios or having stands or being linked to certain brands, it's linked to nationhood, which some would argue is a bit of a 20th century idea in and of itself. But it does create some interesting things that we can then associate with the way a country, the way a nation, the way a set of practices within it are thinking about architecture. And I believe you've kind of mooted a few that caught your eye in the previews this year or that you think will be interesting come opening day. Take us, James, a pious individual as you are, to the Holy See.
Absolutely. The Architecture Biennale this year will see the first ever pavilion of the Holy See, of the Vatican. I actually have an invitation to their opening party in front of me, covered with coats of arms and beautiful titles.
Was yours signed by the Pope? I was very surprised to get that honour myself, but I assume yours was as well. Or was it a lowly cardinal?
It's the lowly Cardinal Gianfranco Ravasi. Okay. But what's interesting about this is not only is it the first pavilion by the Holy See at the Architecture Biennale, but they're doing something quite brave, which is something that you might not expect. I mean, they have the money, of course, to do quite interesting things, but they're occupying an amazing island in the center of the lagoon. It's called the Isola di San Giorgio. It's really well known because if you've been to Venice and you stand on Piazza San Marco and look across the lagoon or the basin of San Mark, you see this church, you see this tower, and you see this sort of glimmering island on the edge. And they're taking space in this island. They're building 10 chapels designed by contemporary architects, all the way from Norman Foster to Smiljan Radic to Eduardo Suter de Moya. But they're also reconstructing a building which is very close to my heart. It's the Woodland Chapel in the Woodland Cemetery in Stockholm, designed by Gunnar Asplund, which really is one of the most important sacred spaces, I think, in the world. It's small, very, very tightly designed, and it's representative, the Vatican believe, of something much larger when we think of chapel designs. So all these pavilions will be occupying one of the few gardens in Venice. And it sort of sounds like it's going to be an incredibly immersive and quite beautiful and tranquil experience.
Well, it's interesting as well, isn't it, if you see, not to put my political hat on too much, but the moves that have been made by the current Pope to be part of debates and to set forth something of a liberal agenda in comparison to previous pontiffs. The Architecture Biennale is kind of a way for nations to be seen abroad, isn't it? Which brings us on to one of your other picks, which are the Baltic nations, who in the past have thumbed their nose at simply being defined by being Estonia or Latvia or Lithuania. But you're very interested in this year's output as well.
I am. You know, in 2016, the Biennale happens every 2 years, as the name would suggest. In 2016, the Baltic Pavilion was one of the most important iterations in this rather anachronistic model of national pavilions. The only other triumvirate of countries that joined together at the Architecture Biennale is the Nordic countries, Finland, Sweden, and Norway. But in 2016, the Baltic countries joined together and created an astonishing show called the Baltic Pavilion. My hope was that it would continue, but it hasn't for various political reasons. Yet, at the same time, every single one of the Baltic pavilions which are going to happen this year, the Estonian pavilion, the Latvian pavilion, the Lithuanian pavilion, are all doing something super interesting. They're being curated by young, emerging, in the grand scheme of things at least, architects, practitioners, curators, artists, and they're all challenging very interesting architectural concepts. The Estonian pavilion, for instance, which is investigating the concept of what they describe as the weak monument and is being curated by Lara Lindsay, Roland Reimer, and Tadias Riha, will look at the architectural environment as a layered and historically continuous system. So they're doing something which is sort of challenging the idea of the contemporary in architecture, I think. They're doing something which is unseen on the whole at the Venice Architecture Biennale, and they're occupying a beautiful old church on the Via Garibaldi. And what's interesting about all three of these pavilions is they don't exist within the sort of formal framework of the Biennale, if you understand what I mean. The national pavilions center on the Giardini, these gardens, but of course the national pavilions which are there and built were built in a different time. They were built in the 20th century, some in the 19th century. They were built at a time when Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania didn't necessarily exist as autonomous nations. So what's interesting about these three pavilions in the grand scheme of the idea of the Biennale is they're occupying the periphery. But I think the periphery this year will become more central than it ever has before.
And this brings us on to the other point, the ambitions, for want of a better word, of the main exhibitions, the free space. What are you looking forward to?
I think, yeah, the point to make is that there are the national pavilions, But there's also the central exhibitions, which, as you say, this year center around the theme of free space, curated by two Irish architects, Yvonne Farrell and Shirley McNamara, who collectively are known as Grafton Architects. Now, full disclosure, I'm part of this exhibition, and I know, therefore, how unbelievably tight the Biennale are being about secrecy around all these things. And, you know, it works both ways. I really have no idea what this is going to look like. All I do know is what I know about the architects, what I know about them as curators, and also the kind of participants that they're bringing into the fore, which are an extremely eclectic group of architects, all the way from Caruso St. John, who are very famous for the sort of advent of a new Swiss, Belgian, British kind of style of architecture, all the way to Crimson architectural historians, who are really architects, but also based very much in activism and obviously architectural history, all the way to Elemental. And Elemental is a Chilean practice run by Alejandro Aravena, who was the curator of the Biennale in 2016. So they've really cast their net wide. Going by what I know of them as architects and the work they've achieved, I suspect it will, on the whole, be a very somber, very serious, but very beautiful exhibition. I think their ambition is to sort of drive back to the heart of what we talk about when we talk about architecture. Architecture as a building practice, architecture as a social condenser. And certainly the idea of free space is a very poetic concept for an event of this scale. It's sort of looking at what can architects, what can designers do when they create buildings, when they create urban projects that give something extra back to civic life, that gives something extra back to public life. They cite examples from architectural history of how simple it is for an architect like Jørn Utzon, who was the designer of the Sydney Opera House, to simply create a sort of folded bench that emerges out of a wall. But of course, having a folded bench coming out of a wall against the idea of just having a wall, it's a very small gesture, but has a very significant consequence for the way that we as citizens, we as occupiers of the built environment, experience that building. So it's all about generosity. And this is something which the Architecture Biennale has never challenged before. It's never sort of looked at social issues through a specifically architectural lens. And I think many people feel like it's high time for the Biennale to go this way. And there is a lot of excitement. I certainly am excited.
Design journalist and the curator of modern architecture at Stockholm's Arkdes Museum, James Taylor Foster there. We'll be bringing you all the fun of the fair from the opening of the Venice Biennale on the show, in print and in films across Monocle 24, a special weekly newspaper, and at monocle.com. Next week.
Some of them are so clued up, it's unbelievable. It's kind of quite a diverse range of knowledge that we have. But some of the kids who come to these workshops really want to be architects, and some are just interested in finding out or want to see what it's all about. So there's a mixture of knowledge.
We finally get round to doing our homework on architecture schools and host a special roundtable with the women at the helm of two of the world's foremost institutions. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.